please the court. This is an interlocutory appeal from an order denying a motion for summary judgment, both a no evidence and traditional motion for summary judgment, in which the appellant Coy Connor sought to be dismissed from the underlying suit on the basis of the doctrine of derived judicial immunity. The facts are largely undisputed, and the law is settled in this area. The question that the court is being asked to decide today is whether Mr. Connor is entitled to judicial immunity for acts that he performed in his capacity as a court-appointed receiver in the appellee's divorce case. This case is an important case for Mr. Connor, of course, but the question that the court's being asked to decide is also of vital importance to the judicial system in Texas. As the court knows, receivers are integral to the judicial process, and this is nowhere more true than it is in the family court system, where receivers are routinely relied upon by the trial judges to inventory property, to protect the marital estate, and to facilitate the court's fair and equitable division of the community estate. Your Honors, we believe that if the trial court's decision in this case is allowed to stand on the facts of this case, derived judicial immunity as it is currently defined in Texas law will, for all practical purposes, no longer exist, at least in the Second District. Professionals like Mr. Connor will be at the very least reluctant to accept court appointments, which would in turn hinder judges from performing their duties. As I mentioned, the material facts are undisputed, and if the court will indulge me, I'd like to go through them very briefly. It's undisputed that on August 23, 2006, Judge Mary Lee Lewis of the 330th District Court in Dallas County issued a temporary injunction enjoining the appellee from destroying or damaging the party's community estate, which included several grocery stores. It's undisputed that the day before that, Judge Lewis contacted the appellant, Mr. Connor, in the presence of the parties and with their consent, and ask if Mr. Connor would be willing to serve as a receiver, which he eventually agreed to do. It's undisputed that on September 22 of 2006, the court entered an order appointing receiver, through which Judge Lewis took possession and jurisdiction of the property, appointed Mr. Connor's receiver, set his bond, and delegated to him a number of duties and responsibilities over the party's assets, including the authority to sell the assets with court approval if it exceeded a certain amount. And finally, it's undisputed that after finding the stores abandoned and in a deteriorated condition, Mr. Connor recommended to Judge Lewis that the stores and property be sold as is, and that the proceeds, of course, be divided between the parties. It's undisputed that the court agreed with that recommendation, that the properties were eventually sold to the highest bidder for an amount that was far exceeded the appraised value of the property, and that the court entered an order approving this sale. And based on these undisputed facts, Your Honors, we believe that Mr. Connor is entitled to judicial immunity, and he should have been dismissed by the trial court under the law of the state.
Isn't there a fact question, though, on the date of his appointment? Because if he was appointed on the 23rd, then, or through the telephone call, then he possibly had some duties. If he wasn't appointed until 22nd of September, then a no evidence summary judgment on he wouldn't have even had any duties until he was appointed.
That's correct. That's a good question, Your Honor. And of course, that is the primary theory that the appellee has advanced for defeating immunity and affirming the trial court's judgment. There are several problems with that. One is, Your Honor, we believe it's immaterial. when he was appointed as receiver. Under the cases that we've cited in our briefs, whether he was appointed on August 23, 2006 or on September 22 of 2006 or any other time, Mr. Connor was entitled to judicial immunity for his acts as a court-appointed receiver. Secondly, even if it's material, even if the date of his appointment is material, the question of whether Mr. Connor had authority as a receiver, we would submit, is a question of law, not a question of fact. And under the law that we've cited in our briefs, including the ex parte Hodges case by the Supreme Court, a receiver in Texas does not obtain authority to act without a court order. And the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code also provides that before a receiver has any authority to act, he must take the oath that the statute provides he take and post the bond that's set by the court. But even if the question of when Mr. Connor had authority to act as a receiver is a question of fact, if you look very closely at the September 22 order, I think you'll find that the order does not say what Mr. Gomez says it says. The order doesn't state that the appointment of Mr. Connor becomes effective on August 23, 2006. Instead, it says that effective August 23, 2006, the court ordered the appointment of Mr. Connor, and that didn't occur until, as the court knows, until September 22 of 2006. I believe this is the only reasonable interpretation you can give this order. Otherwise, you're asking Mr. Connor to perform impossible acts and retroactively and act in situations that he was unaware of until September 22. And I believe this interpretation is also supported by other language in the September 22 order. If, for example, the order, by the way, is in Appendix B of the brief of appellant. If you look at paragraph 2 of page 2 of the order, Judge Lewis states in the present tense that Connor is, quote, appointed and is, quote, hereby authorized to take possession of the property. Then you look at paragraph 3 as a further example. In that paragraph, Judge Lewis orders that banks or other depositors holding any of the properties, the parties' assets, turn over the records pertaining to those assets, quote, upon presentment of this order being the September 22 order. So I think if you look at the September 22 order as a whole and give its terms reasonable meaning, I think there's only one conclusion you can reach, and that is that there was no intent expressed by Judge Lewis that Mr. Connor have some that his appointment be retroactive in its effect and thereby impose on him impossible duties. The second theory that the appellee relies on to defeat immunity is one that's briefed in great detail in the briefs, and that is that under the First Court of Appeals decision in Alpert versus Gerstner, Mr. Connor owed a fiduciary duty analogous to that which a trustee owes the beneficiaries of a trust. And again, we briefed that issue extensively, so I won't repeat our arguments here except to once again point out this, and that is that a distinguishing feature of a receivership as opposed to the trustee of a trust is his or her accountability to the court. A receiver is the court's agent. They act at the court's discretion and at the court's pleasure. They possess only the authority that the court delegates to them. And like the court, receivers are to perform their duties in a disinterested and impartial manner.
Counsel, may I ask a question? Yes. In the Alford case, the way I read it, Justice Jennings, who wrote the opinion, said, quoted from the order appointing the receiver, and it's an order appointing the receiver. And then it goes on in one of the paragraphs below there to say, with the duties of a trustee, mm-hmm. and sets out those duties specifically. But that receiver was appointed as a receiver, and then the court applied a functional analysis.
Correct.
Do you think that the functional, well, I have two questions. One, is there a difference between the Alford case and this case in that the courts talked about, the functional analysis required to determine the duties, whether they were duties owed to the court or to the beneficiaries. And because they weren't, that the receiver there wasn't appointed as a trustee, he was appointed as a receiver with trustee duties.
Well, Your Honor, he was appointed as a receiver, or she was appointed as a receiver, and also appointed as a temporary trustee, and given responsibilities that the trustee was given under the indenture of trust. And I would just simply say, and I think, you know, we've said this in our briefs, that the primary distinction between this case and the Alpert case is that we do not have an indenture of trust here. The receiver in this case was not given trustee responsibilities with regard to a trust or anything of that sort. So that would be the main factual distinction. And we don't believe that Albert is in any way contrary to the position that we've taken in this case. The court's analysis under the functional approach is the very analysis that we asked the court to apply here, which the court's required to apply under the Halsey decision. And if the court applies that functional approach to the duties that this receiver was given under this court order, I think the court will find that this receiver is, in fact, a receiver and has no trustee duties. There's another problem, I believe, with the fiduciary. And let me just point this out, too, that in Davis versus West, I think it's worth noting that the same court, the Albert Court, looking at a receivership very much like this one, applied the functionality test and concluded that the receiver was entitled to derive judicial immunity because the only acts alleged in that case, as in this case, were acts that the receiver took in his capacity as a receiver. In closing, Your Honor, the administration of justice, as this court well knows, this particularly in the civil court system, depends on professionals like Mr. Connor being willing to accept responsibilities as court officers in cases like this without fear of retaliation by disgruntled litigants who don't like the outcome in their cases. Mr. Connor had every reason to believe when he accepted this appointment that the law of immunity would be applied in his case. There's no case in which a pure receiver has been denied judicial immunity or has been held to have possess fiduciary responsibilities to the parties in litigation. I don't think it's overstating it to say if Mr. Connor, under these undisputed facts, does not enjoy immunity, then I can't imagine a situation where a receiver would. I don't know why Judge Wilkinson ruled as she did. With all due respect, we believe she was wrong, and we would ask the court to reverse and to dismiss Mr. Connor from this lawsuit. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, may it please the court. In the appellant's brief in this case, the appellate points to the Gerstner case and in the Rehab Works case, where in both cases the court identify the functional approach to determining whether a receiver is entitled to derive judicial immunity. That flies in the very face of the argument that Mr. Casey just made, in that it doesn't matter when the order became effective, because Mr. Casey said it doesn't matter when this order becomes effective, because we believed by virtue of the fact of his appointment, he is entitled to derive judicial immunity. We would suggest that the appellee would suggest that by virtue of the fact that the court has decided that there must be some examination of what it is the receiver is doing or not doing, and that's a very important thing in this case, not doing, before we determine. We must apply this functional approach before we determine whether or not this receiver is entitled to derive judicial immunity.
Excuse me, are you talking about what the order says he is to do, or what in fact he is doing?
Well, what in fact he is has done, Your Honor, in applying the functional approach, there has to be an examination of what in fact did he do or not do, either an act of commission or an act of omission, which we believe has taken place not only before September 22nd of 2006, but also after September 22nd of 2006, and I'll make that point clear to the court in just a moment. Well, yes, Your Honor, outside the argument of the orders themselves, I understand what the court is saying, and I've seen that statement in our brief as well. Outside, though, the orders themselves, that's correct. But if you look at the orders themselves, and I would point the court's attention both to the order appointing the receiver that signed on September the 22nd of 2006, and then a subsequent order that was signed on November 1st, of 2006, after Mr. Connor had clearly taken up his duties as the receiver in the case, and after Mr. Connor had hired counsel in this case to assist him with the commission of those duties under the order. The first point I want to make to the court is, at that point in time, I too am a member of the bar, and I too think it is very important that we should protect these officers of the court by applying strictly the law with regard to derived judicial immunity. However, in being an officer of the court and a litigant for my client, we also must protect the beneficiaries of these receiverships. And looking at this order that the court executed on September 22nd, 2006, Mr. Casey left out an important word in the first paragraph of that order when he was reciting it to the court. Effective August 23rd, 2006, the court, on motion of Maria D. Guimez and by agreement of the parties, ordered the immediate appointment of Coy Connor as the receiver. Down below that, in the second paragraph, the court, after considering the pleadings of the agreement of the parties, is of the opinion that proper grounds exist for the immediate appointment of a receiver and that the order is necessary to prevent waste and dissipation of the assets to the detriment of both the petitioner and the respondent. And the respondent in this case, Your Honor, is my client, Mr. Guimez.
But you called beneficiary a minute ago, but if this is truly a receivership, he's not a beneficiary.
Well, and technically in the Gerstner case, Your Honor, there was not a trust or a trustee. There was a receiver.
Gave him the, he said he could exercise the sheet, exercise the
same powers without prior approval of the court that the trustee had previously exercised. That's not anywhere near what Mr. Connor was granted in the order appointing him. Instead, the order appointing him is more analogous to the Ramirez case, which is also cited in Alford, which just gives the receiver the right or the duty to maintain or preserve the property. If we find in this case that this receiver is not entitled to derive judicial immunity under this order, I don't see how you're ever going to get a receivership order where they do have the protection of the right to judicial immunity.
Your Honor, if I may complete my argument with regard to the two orders, and it goes back to the court's comment that we made in our brief, talking about that period of time between April the 23rd of 2006 and September the 22nd of 2006. Very clearly, Mr. Connor did things during that period of time to initiate, begin, however the court would like to look at it, his duties as the receiver. He testified in his deposition testimony that he went by the stores and took pictures and did things to prepare himself for receivership. My client, in the summary judgment evidence that was presented in Judge Wilkinson's court, my client stated in his affidavit that his attorney told him at the close of the divorce proceedings in August of 2006, do not return to the stores. We have a receiver appointed. Do not return to the stores. So who is to protect my client if he cannot rely on the court's orders that say effective August 23rd, and his counsel who says do not return to the stores? It is during this period of time the evidence, and I think undisputed evidence, will show that the stores fell into disrepair, fell into ruin, incurred payroll liabilities during that period of time. And so I certainly understand the point that's been made by Mr. Casey with regard to what did Mr. Connor know. We think there is a fact issue as to what did he know at the time that the language of this order was drafted.
But don't we have to first know what his duty is under the order as written, which does not give him trustee-type power that would create a fiduciary duty?
Your Honor, the order as it's written says, the order grants complete and exclusive control, possession, and custody of all receiver assets and receivership records. In the first or the second paragraph of the order, Your Honor, it says that the order is necessary to prevent waste and dissipation of the assets to the detriment of, in part, my client, the petitioner, and then my client, the respondent.
But overall, isn't the order for the purpose of allowing the receiver to wind up the business and sell the stores?
No, Your Honor.
Fairly common.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. In fact, my client in summary judgment evidence indicated that his counsel had spoken with him and said that he was going to be hired as the manager of the grocery stores. It was my client's belief and the full intention of my client at the time of the divorce proceeding that these grocery stores be ran and operated until such time as he could accumulate the funds to purchase the stores or someone else could.
But what your client's belief is not really dispositive of this issue, because what the order says is the court, actually, in paragraph 1, the court hereby takes exclusive possession of the assets, money, security. And the receiver is just simply the arm of the court. And the law says that the judge would have absolute immunity even if the judge went out and trashed the place and had evil intent. So really the issue is not when the receivership began, it's whether derived judicial immunity applies or not, isn't it?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree, because the court has said we must take a functional approach. And if we're going to take a functional approach, we have to look at the function that is being performed by the receiver. And is it within or without of the scope of the order appointing him? That's, if you just ignore the language in Gerstner and the language in Rehab Works and say we're not going to take a functional approach, the only thing we're going to look at is the order appointing this receiver and the date of that order, then exactly what the court is saying is true.
So your allegation that he acted outside the order?
Your Honor, it's our allegations. Your Honor, it's our allegations that on the period of August the 23rd through September the 22nd, there were acts of omission. There were acts of omission, which in turn was a breach of his obligation to these beneficiaries, the respondent and the petitioner in this case. And Your Honor, I understand the court's position with this regard, but it's very, very important to not only my client, but to all, particularly in the family law case, that if a receiver is going to be appointed, that receiver act with some level of responsibility to the order appointing him. The order says prevent waste and dissipation of the assets. That's what the order says. And so if we look at that period of time between August 23rd and September 22nd, number one, did he do that? If we look at the period of time between September the 22nd and November of the 1st, did he again fail to prevent waste and dissipation by not advising my client or correcting the order that appoints him so that all would know the effective date of his receivership is, in fact, September 22nd? That period of time beforehand had no bearing on what Mr. Connor did or didn't do. That at that point in time, my client could have taken action and said, wait a minute, Mr. Hodges, my counsel, told me do not go back to the stores because effective immediately there was a receiver appointed. And so, Your Honor, this period of time is somebody's fault. It's somebody's fault. It's not my client's fault. If this period of time is protected by derived judicial immunity, then this court is basically saying there is not a functional approach. We do not care what the receiver is charged with doing or not doing. We're simply looking at the date on which he was appointed to apply or not apply derived judicial immunity.
But how can he have a duty before he's appointed?
Your Honor, we believe there's a fact issue of what actually transpired. Mr. Casey indicates that it was by agreement of the parties that Mr. Connor was appointed. True, it was by agreement of the counsel in chambers with Judge Lewis. It was not the agreement of my client at the time the agreement was made, and my client does not know what transpired in that telephone call. What he does know is that after that telephone call, he was told by his counsel, do not return to the stores. A receiver has been appointed. Do not return to the stores. Well, Your Honor, if the receiver has the knowledge at that point in time that he's being appointed and he truly has the experience that he represented to this court after the fact that he did have in matters closing this receivership, then he should know. He has an obligation to know that I've got duties here that are arising.
But aren't you imposing on him a fiduciary duty in advance of the order appointing him even?
Well, Your Honor, we don't know what took place, and this was the comment by Judge Wilkinson during the motions for summary judgment hearings. We don't know what took place during that August 23rd. The circumstantial evidence suggests that there was a conveyance of appointment then, even though the counsel of record who agreed to this appointment did not draft the order and get it to the court until 3 weeks later, and my client's grocery stores were in ruin. So I see my time is out. Thank you, Your Honor, unless the court has questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Casey, do you have a rebuttal?
Well, Your Honors, I hope to give the court back some time because I know it's going to be a long afternoon, but there are some matters that I do feel need to be addressed. I would remind the court that the only acts or omissions that have been alleged by Mr. Gomez in this case are acts that are within the receivership order, acts that Mr. Connor performed in his capacity as receiver. All of those acts, when you apply the functional approach, are acts that are intimate to the court's function and are acts that the court would, without a receiver, would be obligated to do, such as inventory assets, value the assets, determine whether the property can be divided without sale, with or without sale of the assets, order the sale of the assets. Everything Mr. Connor did was under the oversight of the trial court and with approval of the trial court. They've alleged nothing that Mr. Connor did beyond that. Mr. Mayo has talked about Mr. Connor doing some things between August 23 and September 22, or not doing some things during that period of time. The evidence is uncontroverted that Mr. Connor had no idea of an appointment being made in any official sense until September 22. The record does not reflect what transpired between August 23 and September 22. But if you look to Mr. Connor's affidavit, which, by the way, is uncontroverted in the summary judgment record, he states that after he was contacted by Judge Lewis, he informed the judge that he was tentatively interested in serving as receiver, but he would need to meet with counsel of the parties and obtain some more information. He met with Gomez's counsel. He was informed that Mr. Gomez had abandoned all but possibly one of the stores. It was not until, and this is Mr. Connor, it was not until September 22, 2006, that I actually received any notification that I had been officially appointed as receiver in this case. That's uncontroverted. Mr. Gomez's affidavit.
Mm-hmm. Affidavit, yes. He says that Mr. Connor was appointed on August 23rd, and all of the six stores were operational. And between his appointment and the date of the original order, all of the stores except one were forced to close because no one was tending. The payrolls weren't made. The employees quit showing up. And then he says, according to the order appointing Mr. Connor as a receiver, I depended on him to manage the stores in such a way as to prevent the waste of assets. So it seems like there is a fact question, or at least a controversy.
Well, Your Honor, for one thing, I don't believe Mr. Gomez is qualified to state a legal opinion as to when Mr. Connor's appointment became effective. And if that's, I realize that he made that statement, but I don't believe that that's competent evidence of when Mr. Connor was appointed. So I don't believe that evidence conflicts with the competent testimony of Mr. Connor and the other evidence in the record showing that he was officially appointed by the court. I'm sorry, go ahead, Mr.
I was thinking, does this case then require us to interpret that judgment as a matter of law? Order, not judgment.
Well, Your Honor, again, we believe that whether Mr. Connor was appointed on August 23 or whether he was appointed on September 22, it's immaterial, and that's just a red herring, that the doctrine of judicial immunity would apply regardless. If you look at the cases, the federal cases in the Supreme Court decisions and Court of Appeals decisions that we've cited that are cited in both parties' briefs, the doctrine applies, or the immunity applies, regardless whether the acts are bad or good, there's omissions or commissions. It's the same policy considerations for protecting this panel for any acts that this panel performs in its judicial function apply to receivers who, under the functional approach, are performing acts as agents for the court under the doctrine of derived judicial immunity. So,
thank you.